Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. Last Friday, the Department of Justice, or DOJ, and the city of Albuquerque announced a settlement agreement guiding mandated Albuquerque Police Department, or APD, reforms. The reforms contained in the consent decree address previous DOJ findings of use of excessive force and other APD civil rights violations. The City Council will have an opportunity to review and question the agreed-upon reforms before a monitor steps in to chart APD's progress in complying with set goals within a four-year time frame. What does the agreement mean for citizens and for APD? Does the agreement seek to reverse the Albuquerque Police Department's trend toward militarization of its force? How will citizens discover whether APD is meeting reform benchmarks? We begin a two-part conversation regarding the settlement agreement reached between the City of Albuquerque and the Department of Justice. We hope you will join us next Thursday morning as we welcome Mayor Richard Berry, APD Chief Gordon Eden, and APD Academy Director Joe Wolf to the show. Today, however, joining me in studio to discuss the consent decree are Peter Simonson, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, Albuquerque Civil Rights Attorney Shannon Kennedy, a member of the legal team of APD Forward, and Radley Balco, the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, the Militarization of America's Police Forces, and a Washington Post opinion blogger. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for being here today. Radley Balco, let's begin with you. You are in Albuquerque for an event tonight at the South Broadway Cultural Center, where you'll be speaking on the topic of the Rise of the Warrior Cop, the title of your book, beginning at 7 p.m. The full title of your book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, the Militarization of America's Police Forces. When you use the term militarization to describe a police force or forces, what is meant by the use of that term?
I think there are two areas where we've seen militarization of police forces in the United States. The first is just in terms of weapons, equipment, and tactics. And this has been going on since about the early 1980s. What we've seen increasingly is police departments getting actual military gear through the Pentagon surplus program. So this is stuff that was designed for use on a battlefield. We're talking machine guns and tanks and helicopters and armored personnel carriers being transferred to local police departments for use on, you know, American streets and in American neighborhoods. After September 11th, the Department of Homeland Security started giving out grants to police departments to buy new equipment, which has also given rise to sort of a cottage industry of corporations that exist solely to build this new military-type equipment in exchange for this money from DHS. So that's one area where we're talking about SWAT teams, we're talking about guns, armor, armored vehicles. The other area is more sort of a mentality or a mindset that we've seen, I think, taking over in too many police departments. And it goes with the weapons and the tactics and the uniforms and the camouflage, but it goes beyond the SWAT teams. It's a kind of an us versus them mentality. You know, the traditional police motto, protect and serve, that LAPD made famous, you know, today is gone. If you look at online police forums, for example, where police officers sort of talk amongst themselves, you know, and are open, the model you'll see over and over again is something to the effect of whatever I need to do to get home at night. And that's a very sort of battlefield kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. It's something that's more concerned about, you know, self-preservation than serving and protecting the community.
Well, and a little different than Albuquerque's motto, which I believe is on the police cars, which is in step with the community.
Right. And this is we've really moved away from community policing. And, you know, I emphasize in my book that this isn't about individual police officers. You know, I'm not anti-cop. The book is an anti-cop. Most of the criticism is really directed at policymakers and politicians. I think the people who put these policies in place and who haven't exercised good oversight over police departments and allowed this militarization, both types, to happen.
Well, I'm guessing you have more than a passing knowledge, given what you've written about, of what has been happening here in Albuquerque over the past year, specifically with regard to the DOJ issuing a report in April condemning the operation of the APD and its culture and use of excessive force and other civil rights violations, and now last Friday on Halloween, the city and DOJ announcing a settlement agreement that charts a path forward for reform of APD. Have you been able to frame, or are we able to frame, what has been happening here with the APD in relation to the militarization of our police force? Is there a correlation or connection with the actions and culture of the APD that has caused unnecessary loss of life and liberty and the phenomenon of militarization?
Yeah, so I think you've seen in Albuquerque and New Mexico generally a consistent scene with the rest of the country, which is more SWAT teams, vast increase in the number of SWAT raids, the use of SWAT-style tactics for increasingly petty offenses to serve warrants on people suspected of drug crimes is the overwhelming use of SWAT teams all over the country. But also, I think the mindset problem has really been prevalent here. Going back to the early 1990s, Albuquerque was having problems with excessive force, with lethal force. They brought in a criminologist, Sam Walker, from the University of Nebraska, who did a review and said the shootings in Albuquerque were off the charts. And the city went through a kind of a reform program. They brought in a reform-minded police chief who didn't last long, and everything sort of cycled again. I think we're sort of seeing a repeat of what happened in the early 1990s here. There is a definite shift in mentality of police when it comes to lethal force. I've interviewed lots of people who train police officers in the use of lethal force. One thing they say that they've noticed, and these are people who tend to agree with my general outlook on this, but they've noticed that there's been a less of an emphasis on de-escalation and conflict resolution in these lethal force classes and more of an emphasis on things like how to justify force after you've already used it. So we're moving away from this idea that a cop should seek to de-escalate a situation first. That should be the first priority, to this kind of force science concept, which says that police need to be shooting people more often. That's the message you get from a lot of these courses. And you've seen this in New Mexico. There's a big controversy with the new director of the police academy, who adopts this mindset, kill zone kind of force science mentality that police officers need to get over their tendency to hesitate before shooting people. It's a really sort of disturbing development, but I think it's really that, I think, is one of the national trends that we're really seeing on prominent display here in Albuquerque.
And next week we'll have on Joe Wolf, who's the civilian director of the APD Academy, and we'll be talking with him and we can ask him more questions about that. Peter Simonson, let's go to you for a minute. The ACLU is a member of APD Forward, and we mentioned Shannon Kennedy also being a member of that. But tell us, if you would, about that organization and why the ACLU is a member of that, please.
Sure. It's a coalition of 20 organizations across our city who represent many of the populations that bear the brunt of some of APD's excesses over the years. Organizations that represent our homeless population, that represent people who have mental illness, the Native American population, as well as faith groups, professional associations, as I say, about 20 different organizations. And they're all very concerned about seeing a reform that is successful. We here in Albuquerque have gone through now three cycles of police violence in the last 40 years. And this is the first time that we've actually had a federal agency intervene and try to impose a reform process on the department. And it's, I think, the organizations involved in APD Forward feel like it's imperative that we take full advantage of this opportunity because it may not come around again in our lifetime. And so, you know, of course, the ACLU's mission is to protect civil rights and civil liberties. And so this falls squarely within our interests and our mission.
Does APD Forward have a formal role in the reform process, or is you sort of an outside group looking in and saying, hey, let's stick to our promises here?
Yeah, we don't have a formal role, but it's not an unimportant one. I think it's critically important that the community has an organized way of putting pressure on the city to hold its feet to the fire, to hold it accountable to this reform process. Because what we've seen in other cities where these arrangements are made between the Department of Justice and the police departments, that while they can be successful, they oftentimes are not if the community is not integrally involved, is not scrutinizing what the police department is doing and whether or not it's living up to the terms of the agreement.
Shannon Kennedy, you are a member of the legal team of APD Forward. Good morning to you, and thanks for being here. What led you to participate with the group?
Well, what led me to participate with the group was that I've had the honor and privilege of representing a number of people who've lost family members as a result of the violence of the city of Albuquerque. I mean, there have been 37 police shootings in the last 5 years, 27 of them fatal. And I currently represent a number of the families who've lost loved ones. And we have to remember that the Department of Justice is here because of the voices of those families. I had the honor of representing Ken Ellis's family. A 5-year-old boy lost his father, a man who had served his country in Iraq. And his father, Ken Ellis, was so critical in bringing the Department of Justice to our community. And so to honor my clients, I want to be part of APD Forward so that we reach the goal of constitutional community policing.
Now, you are also an attorney representing the family of James Boyd. Is that correct?
That's correct. James Matthew Boyd.
And a lot of people see that video that we saw of what happened in the foothills as sort of the genesis of this final push by community members, if not otherwise, for things to really start moving here.
That video shines a light on, it's really the culmination of all of the different things that have gone wrong with the city of Albuquerque Police Department.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about that, because clearly, you know, we've heard Radley Balco talk about militarization and how we can frame some of those issues in that light. How else can we frame what happened in the foothills there?
It's the acceptance of a culture within APD and within specialized units where one of the two shooting officers, Keith Sandy, 2 hours before the shooting, called James Matthew Boyd an expletive lunatic, basically dehumanizing him in front of other officers. He proceeds to talk about being able to use his taser shotgun, and that this rope department has a taser shotgun. And a taser shotgun is sort of like a unicorn weapon. It's so exciting to have this, and I'm going to be using this in the next 2 hours. So first of all, it's emblematic of excessively deploying tactical units to use ad hoc SWAT tactics and weapons to confront and escalate a situation of someone in a mental health crisis.
Well, and the mental health crisis aspect of it obviously is huge as well.
Well, absolutely, because people in a mental health crisis cannot obey orders. And officers are trained, if they're not obeying my order, they're a danger. And so there's a fear-based response. Instead of a response of, this is a mental health crisis, we need to de-escalate the situation, time is on our side, distance is on our side. Instead, we have dispatched to the scene ad hoc 41 officers in militarized gear. You can see from the video the manner in which they approach him. It's almost as if they're on a hunt. And so we have this body camera, this helmet cam that captures what happens. So for the first time, they cannot cover it up with the whole narrative of he threatened me with a knife. I mean, in reading the investigation that was recently released, but for that video, this is another shooting that the department would have justified. Chief Eaton stood up and said it was justified. Not even understanding the implications of the video. That's how entrenched this culture is.
Now, Peter Simonson, you've been with us before when we discussed this issue when the DOJ report came out, and thank you for being here again. So the ACLU has really been speaking to the militarization issue. Was there a report that's been issued by the ACLU that we can direct people to?
Yeah, I would certainly encourage people to go to the National ACLU website or to the APD Forward website, where they can find links to a report that the National ACLU released in June of this year called The War Comes Home. And what it does is it aggregates data from police departments all around the country and demonstrates the way in which SWAT teams have grown from their traditional use of responding to hostage situations, live shooters, snipers, imminently threatening situations, to servicing routine drug warrants. In fact, and I think Radley can talk about this in more detail, but today's SWAT team is heavily engaged in carrying out routine police activities like serving drug search warrants. In fact, that's its primary responsibility today. It is moved entirely away from the original mission of trying to protect people against an imminent threat.
Now, I read that your organization would be undertaking a detailed review of the consent decree or settlement agreement. Has the organization, has the ACLU completed its review?
Yes, and Shannon was an integral part of that process, along with, I believe, four or five other of our best and brightest civil rights attorneys here in the community. And yesterday we released that to the press. We'll be putting up a written version of that analysis on the APD Forward website. And, you know, it discusses overall that this is a very good thing for the city of Albuquerque. The finally arriving at the settlement agreement is a major step forward. There are places where we feel like it could be stronger. There are things that we think it really appears to do well.
Well, we've heard Radley Balco address the militarization issue here this morning, and Shannon did as well, and a little bit about the mental health issues. Based on the review, the ACLU's review of this 106-page settlement agreement, does the document speak to those issues, or to what does the document speak? What foundational issues does a consent decree address and seek to reform? Can we sort of summarize it?
If you're looking in there for a decree that APD will no longer use military equipment or even use military tactics, you probably won't find it in there. But, you know, you will find some of the important references to ensuring that APD increases its engagement with the community, that it commits itself to the use of body-worn cameras in a way that it hasn't done up to this point.
Is that a requirement now for every officer to wear that?
Well, they are required. Under policy, yes, it is. The question is whether or not those policies are enforced,
right.
And that has been the age-old problem inside APD. I think, you know, while this settlement agreement does set forth that requirement, one of our concerns is that it doesn't require the use of body-worn cams in all of the situations in which we'd like to see them used. I believe it's mostly use of force encounters. We'd really like to see it used in every encounter, and not just for the safety of the community, but for the safety of the officer as well. I mean, all of these reforms will not just improve the safety of our community. They will also go a great deal, a long ways in actually increasing the safety of our officers.
And when we step back from that us versus them mentality, whichever way it comes, then we do become concerned about the safety of all involved in a situation. If you would like to join in our discussion about the settlement agreement reached between the City of Albuquerque and the DOJ, setting out a path of reform for APD, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Do you have confidence in APD's ability to reform or to be reformed? Confidence in the city leaders who are signing on to and committing to the reforms? We'll be back with our guests and with your calls and comments after this short break.
All are welcome to the Amnesty International Regional Conference November 7th through the 9th at the Embassy Suites in Albuquerque. Speakers and workshops will focus on immigration, police brutality, lobbying for human rights, ending the forever war, nonviolent direct action, and other human rights issues and strategies. Get more information at amnestyusa.org/regionals. That's amnestyusa.org/regionals. A message from the tax-exempt Amnesty International.
Escuela del Sol Montessori, celebrating over 45 years of preschool through elementary education, is having an open house on Sunday, November 9th from 1 to 3 p.m. Escuela del Sol is New Mexico's oldest Montessori school and the only school in New Mexico accredited by the American Montessori Society. For information about the school's programs, attend an open house on Sunday, November 9th, and visit escueladelsol.org. A message from the tax-exempt Escuela del Sol.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about the consent decree, otherwise known as the settlement agreement reached between the City of Albuquerque and the Department of Justice, setting out the reforms for the Albuquerque Police Department, a pathway to those reforms. And today I'm joined in the studio by Peter Simonson, the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, Albuquerque Civil Rights Attorney Shannon Kennedy, a member of the legal team of APD Forward, and Radley Balco, the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, and a Washington Post opinion blogger. So let's go ahead to our first caller. We've got our full lines, as we expected today. Let's bring in Bill from Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, good morning. If the cameras are not positioned on eye level, any place else, they're worthless. And why is it that whenever the police department gets in trouble, they're flooded with millions and millions of dollars to fix it, which is not necessary? Thank you.
All right, Bill, thanks so much for your call. Radley, you want to talk a bit about Bill's comment, please?
Well, police cameras, it's an interesting issue. I generally agree with the ACLU's position on them, which is that they're an important transparency tool, provided that there are certain policies in place to guide them. For instance, we need to protect the privacy of people who may be, you know, inadvertently caught on a police camera who'd have nothing to do with the particular situation. But the other thing is there is a problem where video, these cameras can sometimes mysteriously malfunction at critical times, or video can go missing. And there's a criminal defense attorney who has a popular blog, Scott Greenfield in New York, who coined the term the missing video presumption. And it's a policy that I think makes a lot of sense, which is that if the police were, if there should be a video of this particular incident, and there isn't one because either the officer forgot to turn on the camera or the video was, you know, accidentally erased, or not accidentally erased, any litigation that follows, the court or the jury should sort of assume that the video would have corroborated the non-officer's interpretation of events. And I think that would provide a strong incentive for the police to make sure that the officers are using the cameras appropriately and that the video is, you know, preserved and protected so that it doesn't go missing. As it stands now, if the video goes missing, you're sort of out of luck. I mean,
right.
That's the way the case law is developed.
Well, and we had an email comment from Richard who said, lapel cameras seem to have technical difficulties often, as you mentioned, whether they actually have them or conveniently have them. Dash cams have limitations, but why not require them to run 24/7 as an additional measure to monitor police? What about dash cams?
There are some issues in terms of storing the data, how the data can be stored and preserved. There are issues with cloud security, and these come up in the debates. But there are lots of departments actually that are using cameras and using them well. And you know, the few studies that have been done have shown that not only do police behave better on camera, but citizens behave better on camera. And so you get, you know, video will exonerate police of false charges. And it also leads not only to fewer incidents of police conduct, but fewer complaints about misconduct from citizens. So it works on both sides.
Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Sarah from Albuquerque. Good morning, Sarah.
Yes, good morning. I do have my opinion, and I feel that this issue is way too overrated. Because, you know, about 80 pedestrians have gotten killed by cars last year in Bernalillo County alone. You know, more people get killed by auto-related deaths than all the police shootings put together every year. I was told that, talking to a former sergeant, that this is violent deaths, drug-related deaths, police shootings, you know, like domestic violence deaths, everything put together does not compare to drunk drivers, auto accidents, people getting killed at intersections.
All right, Sarah, thanks so much for your call and for making your point. Shannon Kennedy, let me go to you, because so Sarah said this is too overrated, the police use of excessive force, and yet the police are there to protect us. Their presence is always with us. How would you respond to Sarah, please?
My response to Sarah is that she is right. There's tons of problems in our community around DWI and bad driving, and they're no less important. We're here talking about the abuse of power by police, and the police are supposed to serve the public. And individuals who are privately misbehaving suffer consequences as a result. For instance, someone driving drunk who is caught is arrested. The officers who have taken lives in our community have suffered no individual consequences. And one of the best parts about this consent decree is a new internal affairs bureau in which we can hope that in the future resources are used to objectively evaluate police shootings so that the individual officers who have killed someone without cause are held accountable.
Mm-hmm. Peter, I want you to listen to this email comment. I'd like your response to it, please. This is an email comment from Charles, who says, I see nothing at this point in time that shows that these, quotation marks, leaders, unquote, are interested in garnering the community's trust in believing they will be accountable in the future when they have refused to be accountable for their past. Why has the Department of Justice placed trust in these same leaders?
Well, I'm not sure it's entirely true that the Department of Justice has placed all of its trust in our city leaders. I think
because this is in fact an agreement that can be enforced in court. Is
exactly,
it not?
Exactly. So and they have been very adamant from the beginning, and APD Forward has also been adamant from the beginning that this agreement needs to be overseen by a federal court. And what's more, that there will be a federal monitor that will regularly analyze how the APD is performing and whether or not it's living up to the terms of this agreement. And you know, at the end of the day, there is the possibility of seeking a contempt of court motion that would impose possibly fines or other kinds of penalties on the department. So, you know, I don't think it is true that DOJ doesn't walk into this entirely naive of who they're dealing with. But by the same token, I think that we have seen evidence of some good faith within the city that there is interest to see reform. There is some acknowledgement of problems. I think many of us would have preferred to see a much more forthcoming acknowledgement of the problems that the department has suffered from. At the end of the day, this consent decree is not the solution. It's not a magic bullet. It is an opportunity to try and push for reforms that haven't been possible in the past. And, you know, we as a community and the Department of Justice as well have to take as great advantage of that as possible.
Tell us briefly about the monitor. When will that monitor be appointed? Who will it be? And what is the job of the monitor, if you would, please?
Great question. As I read from the consent decree, from the settlement agreement, the monitor should be in place within 60 days. And I understand that now the city and the Department of Justice are in negotiations about who that would be. We in APD Forward, and I think Shannon can corroborate this, that we really feel like it has to be a monitor that's appointed from outside the state, and that somebody who has had former experience with a consent decree of this magnitude, of this nature. I don't think that we want to rely on someone here in the state that already shares relationships with our city leadership. Not only do we not want to see this agreement entangled with other sorts of politics in our community, but we want the community to have confidence that the monitor is actually doing his or her job. And we feel like the best way to accomplish that is to make sure that we've got an experienced monitor from out of state.
If it's someone who does come in from out of state, would they move here? And then would they have a day-to-day presence or connection with the reforms?
I think Radley may have more experience with how these kinds of monitors are carried out.
Because this is, in fact, the 15th city, perhaps, I think, that has had this kind of situation. Radley, what will happen?
I think it depends on the city and the terms of the consent decree, just how active the monitor, a role the monitor will have, and where the monitor will actually be located. But if I could, I wanted to address the previous caller's point, because I think, you know, in a lot of ways, when the Justice Department gets involved in overseeing your local police department, it is a failure on the local level. And the thing that I think a lot of people overlook when we have these police misconduct issues or abuse of power issues is that, you know, the mayor is an elected position, the city council is an elected position, the sheriff's an elected position, district attorney is an elected position. These issues can be part of campaigns and of elections. I mean, if the people, if the community are very concerned about these issues, they can make that known. They can vote on these issues. They can, you know, they can force candidates to address these issues. I think a big part of the problem here is that that criminal justice issues, police abuse issues aren't seen as political issues. They aren't seen as issues that should be discussed during campaigns. And they should. I mean, if you are concerned about this, the next time there's one of these, elections for any of these positions, make your voice known and force these people to address these issues before they get into office.
All right. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller from Albuquerque. It's Benjamin. Good morning, Benjamin.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen. I just want to say, first of all, that I really appreciate this conversation because this is just hugely important. I sort of disagree with the last caller that more of a problem, or less of a problem, rather, than pedestrians getting hit by cars, because people are accountable to people. And my comment is that I think lapel cameras and police worn cameras are necessary all the time. And the reason is that as we're on camera, we become accountable to one another in a way that is real and tangible. And police officers never know when they're going to be necessarily engaged in force or the act of force. So it should be all the time, or cameras should be on all the time instead of like when an officer thinks they're going to be engaged in violence. And I'll listen to the responses off.
All right. Thanks so much, Benjamin, for your call today. And that's a good point, is it not, Shannon, that people are unaware when the excessive force issues are going to arise? I'm sure you've had clients where it started out as something simple and then escalated.
Certainly, and the existence of a body camera is going to prevent the escalation. And so, yes, they should be on at all times.
But let's the privacy part of it. Is that do you consider that to be an important part?
It's a very important part. I mean, certainly there are times in which police officers need to have private conversations with people about parts of their investigation. That's very different than a patrol situation or a call out to a mental health crisis. Also, there's privacy considerations. If there's a female victim or a male victim of domestic violence and they want to talk privately about what they're experiencing with a police officer to seek help, certainly there's no need to record those conversations. The key to body cameras is the uploading of the evidence from the camera. And I would hope that we have a budget here of between $4 and $6 million a year to enforce this agreement, and that a substantial part of that budget goes to hiring an evidence technician to spend the time to properly upload the data from these cameras, instead of having it be this piecemeal thing where an individual officer is supposed to be tagging it into evidence. The officers need to be out on the street doing their jobs, and the city needs to hire an evidence technician so that it is a pattern and practice of properly tagging into evidence and uploading the data from these cameras. The technology now exists to do it right, and in those police departments around the country where the technology is being properly tagged into evidence by an evidence technician, the number of excessive use of force or force reports themselves have dropped considerably.
So that practice is important. Now, Peter, let's go back, though, just a little bit, because should we now just have an expectation when we encounter a police officer that we are being filmed? Or is there an opportunity for police officers to ask us, do you consent to being filmed?
Well, you know, something similar, I guess. I think we'd like to see in the policy a requirement that officers affirmatively state when they approach a civilian that they are actually, that they do have a body-worn camera and that it's on, and that they can be asked to turn it off in the event of, you know, I think Shannon mentioned in the case of witness statements, confidential informant statements, and victim statements. I think those are some key areas where you obviously do want to protect privacy.
And these are all policies that can be fashioned within the police department. They don't necessarily have to be part of the consent decree?
Absolutely. But again, you know, a policy is only as good as the people who are actually enforcing it. And so if there aren't actual disciplinary consequences for failure to abide by those policies, then these body-worn cameras will not have the impact that we've seen in places like Rialto, California, where citizen complaints about use of force dropped by, I believe, 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%. Use of force incidents themselves actually drops dramatically. Those are the kinds of impacts that we could see by a properly enforced body-worn cam policy. And we here in Albuquerque haven't had the benefit of a properly enforced policy yet. And I think many of us are hopeful that if it were properly enforced, it could be a significant ingredient in the reform process.
Let's bring in our next caller. It's Alan from Albuquerque. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. Thanks for having the show. And
sure.
Long overdue. I'm a lifelong resident of New Mexico and Albuquerque, and I have several friends who work at City Hall. And they've told me I've talked to them, you know, away from City Hall several times, and they're extremely pessimistic. They don't think anything's going to change. And I say, why not? And they say, because the people in the department now who are in leadership roles, they're just shifting them around from one role to another role. They're not. There's no cleaning of house or anything like that, and no accountability in terms of what's been going on up until now. Anyway, they have an ear on the inside, and that's their central concern, is that there's not going to be any fundamental change of that culture, because the leadership of that culture remains in City Hall. It's in APD, this shifting people around to other positions.
All right, Alan, thanks so much for your call. Let's get our guests to comment. And Radley, generally, I mean, when you've looked at these situations around the country, everything, there's always an exception, but does leadership stay the same, and can true change happen?
Well, usually when true change happens, it's because you bring somebody outside the fold in, you know, as the police chief, and that's where you get real sort of significant reform. It's difficult. The people who are overseeing this, the people who are supposed to be imposing the consequences, are the political leaders. And again, I go back to this idea of political pressure. You know, if your mayor and city council aren't holding the police accountable and the voters aren't responding by holding them accountable for that lack of accountability, you're not going to get, you know, any change. And so I think it, you know, if you want accountability, I think it has to, that message has to be sent clearly, I think, to the politicians, because that's ultimately, you know, who has the direct oversight.
And Peter, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, just a couple things. One, I guess I'm going to say something that's not particularly popular among our ranks, but I'll say it anyways because I believe it, and that is, from my observation, I do sense a commitment on the behalf of the chief to engage in these reforms. The story obviously hasn't been written yet, and this is going to be a very challenging process. So we still have yet to see whether or not we have proper leadership in place. But from my observation, I have seen from Chief Eden, a real interest in carrying through with the reforms. But I think one of the pieces of this reform process that doesn't get enough attention is the challenge that leadership, regardless of their commitment, has in bringing this to the rank and file officers. What we need to see in this department is a change in culture and an agreement by officers that by de-escalating situations in the way Shannon talked about, Shannon mentioned gaining time, gaining distance as a positive effect of having an encounter with a citizen. That is a way to de-escalate. That is going to be trying to persuade officers that is for their own safety as well as the community's safety is going to be an immense challenge. And as I understand, I visited the Las Vegas Police Department with the Albuquerque Chamber and some of our city leadership to find out about their reform process. And one of the things that they talked about was that officers, when they're approached with this de-escalation training, tend to interpret it as a kind of a weakness, that in encounters with civilians, it feels like a weaker posture to be de-escalating, and that you should be asserting yourself, being more take charge. And so that's part of the cultural change that we need to see happen. And it's going to have to be leadership that makes that happen. And it's going to, the message is going to have to come down through the ranks. And the chief is going to have to put his stamp on this reform process. It can't not, it is going to have to be a very assertive process from the top on down.
I want to let Alan and all our listeners know that we have had previous discussions on these topics, and you can find those shows on our archives and our KUNM.org on our call-in show webpage. We also invite you to join our discussion next week. We will welcome Mayor Richard Berry, APD Chief Gordon Eden, and APD Academy Director Joe Wolf to the show to continue this conversation. Today, however, joining me are Shannon Kennedy, a member of the legal team of APD Forward, and Albuquerque civil rights attorney, Peter Simonson, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, and Radley Balco, the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. If you would like to join in our discussion, again today. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Tell us, does a settlement agreement go far enough to bridge the gap between the police and the community they serve? We'll be back with you after this short break.
When did Andy Griffith become G.I. Joe? Find out by joining Radley Balco, author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, on Thursday, November 6th at 7 p.m. at the South Broadway Cultural Center in Albuquerque. Tickets are not required, but space is limited. So please RSVP online at apdforward.org. That's apdforward.org. A message from the tax-exempt ACLU.
Virginia Gridell of Tijeras writes, I had an excellent experience during the donation of my 1996 GMC Sierra truck to KUNM. All aspects were clearly explained on the initial phone conversation. The date of pickup was arranged to my convenience, and the tow service arrived exactly during the time frame indicated. All of the paperwork was easy to understand and processed as described. It all worked easily and effectively. Thanks, Virginia. Donate your car or truck at 888-KUNM-CAR. Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about the Albuquerque Police Department, militarization, and the settlement agreement reached between the city of Albuquerque and the Department of Justice, charting a path of reforms for APD. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller to the program. It's Judy from Albuquerque. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, what might gun control what might the effects of gun control be on APD and, for that matter, other police departments in the country?
All right. Let's go ahead and get our guests to comment on that call. Thanks so much for your call, Judy.
I'll go ahead and weigh in on that. This is a common, I don't know, criticism isn't the right word, but it's a common complaint from police that, or counter-argument, I guess, that they need militarization because the citizenry is increasingly armed and that it's sort of a weapons race going on. There isn't actually a lot of empirical data to support that. The DOJ has done a couple studies over the years and found that the kind of weapon that's used in most homicides tends to be a handgun of a small caliber handgun. Same with the weapon overwhelmingly used in killing when police officers are killed. And in fact, both the crime rate has been dropping dramatically since the mid-90s and the rate of killing of police officers on the job has been dropping. In fact, last year was the safest year for police officers on the job in over 100 years, if you look at the rate of fatalities on the job. I think gun control is a separate issue. I think there are, that is a debate that we are having and needs to be had. I don't think that it is it's particularly relevant to the police militarization debate.
All right, let's step back a bit because we have an email comment from a listener, George, who says, as usual, the conversation is shifting towards accountability and militarization. Little is said about mental health issues. Now, we did talk a bit about mental health issues already on this program. I don't know if there's something particular George is looking for us to say, but let's talk about how the agreement specifically addresses mental health issues. Peter, if you want to jump in.
Sure, and I guess part of that's because you've got some civil liberties experts up here on the panel, and maybe no one necessarily that particularly represents the health, mental health community, but I will add that APD Forward, we do have multiple members of the coalition that represent people with disabilities, the homeless population, and, Nancy Koenigsberg, for example, legal director for Disability Rights New Mexico, looked in depth at the consent decree, and there are a number of things in here that she found to be positive. Strengthening the crisis intervention process within APD. I think another positive aspect of the consent decree is a requirement that APD engage with a community mental health advisory committee that would actually give input to the APD about their interactions with people with mental illness and provide consultation on those really challenging situations that occur. For example, a mentally ill person who's barricaded him or herself and is threatening suicide. Those are very difficult situations, and I think to the degree that APD is really engaging our mental health professionals in helping to facilitate safe outcomes in those kinds of situations, I think, you know, the settlement agreement will help promote that.
And just a few other things that the settlement agreement requires the department to do, and I believe these were pointed out by Jeff Proctor in an Albuquerque Journal article from the 31st of October. The department must collect and track data on calls for trained crisis intervention officers. The department must also beef up its contacts with the chronically homeless and individuals with mental illness who have a history of law enforcement encounters in order to help connect these individuals with mental health service providers. So a proactive approach. Shannon, are you that's something that would go a long way. Would that help? It would have helped people that we know of, certainly.
Certainly it would have helped. I mean, had these new rules and regulations been followed, James Matthew Boyd would still be alive today. There's no doubt that, and the Torres family as well. I mean, we had a situation in Albuquerque, and hopefully it's going to change, in which there are no supervisors on duty on the weekend. There was no supervision of the rope team, which has now been disbanded.
When the rope team, meaning the?
The repeat offender program.
Okay.
And so basically, being mentally ill and being homeless has been criminalized by the city of Albuquerque Police Department. So someone like James Matthew Boyd was in this revolving circle of being on the streets or in jail. His family couldn't find him for years because no one was tracking his existence. Now with Obamacare, many, many people who didn't have access to mental health care are now being signed up. And so the federal government, for the first time, is putting money into our communities to provide mental health care to the people on the streets. The only piece missing is housing. Mm. And so, for instance, I mean, what we're looking for, what James Matthew Boyd's family is looking for, are homes, not handcuffs. That's the motto of the changes that they're trying to make, is that we need to provide housing to stabilize people now that they have medication, instead of them recycling in and out of the Metropolitan Detention Center.
All right. There's a caller on our line, Peter from Albuquerque, who wants to speak to this point. And Peter, we've had a bit of a discussion here already. Is there more that you're wondering is in the agreement? Have you reviewed the agreement and you're unhappy with it? Talk to us a little bit about this issue.
Thank you. I have read the agreement carefully, and my occupation is working for people with disabilities. I'm very concerned about the agreement in two ways. First, the very point that was just made about having law enforcement engage more with people experiencing homelessness or people who appear to have a psychiatric problem, I think is wrongheaded altogether. We need mental health professionals, social workers, and caseworkers. In extreme circumstances, ambulances, to have encounters with people who are having these kinds of problems on our streets. But having law enforcement officials have more encounters with these people is the absolutely wrong thing to be doing.
You know, and Peter, just briefly, on one of our earlier programs on this issue, we did have an expert on, and I cannot remember his name off the top of my head, who said that's one of our issues here. We're asking law enforcement to do jobs that they traditionally haven't done and not trained to do, and that community members are much better at doing.
Thank you. And so my point would be that if there is a 911 call and someone says someone's having a crisis, that the last thing we need is someone in a blue uniform with a gun to go to that circumstance most of the time. And so I think that there's a problem in the structure of this agreement in terms of what it is in it. But I think that what the agreement does not do is even more important, and that is it does not take on the policy of our mayor and the city government, which is that we sweep the streets of people who appear to be mentally ill, that we are having law enforcement officials target them, go to them, give them problems, steal their backpack, destroy their identification, and oftentimes it escalates into violence and then fabricated arrest. And so I really want to call on the mayor to speak to this. He vetoed the legislation passed by our city council that would have afforded $16 million for mental health services. And I think he needs to account for himself, because what he has done is he has said, we're going to put these people in jail, get them out of sight, and we're not going to pay for the care that they need. And I think that is a huge hole in this agreement.
All right, Peter, thanks so much for your call. Peter Simonson, is there room for, I mean, you said there was a general lack of acknowledgement about certain actions on the part of city leaders, but is there room for, in this agreement, for more change to happen and to address some of the issues that Peter just spoke of in working with the homeless population?
Well, you know, Peter's identified a number of different issues, and I actually want to clarify one of my comments about the interaction with the mentally ill population. I think the positive aspect of the agreement is that it will engage officers with mental health professionals to better advise them in those situations where they do come into contact with people who have mental illness. But I agree with Peter's point that at the end of the day, officers are not the right people to be interacting as the first contact with the first responder in many situations. Beyond that, I think the agreement and this whole agreement process has actually given us the opportunity to bring some of these very issues to the attention of the APD and to the mayor. It's outside of the scope of the consent decree to some degree, which is really focused on the use of force. But we have used APD Forward has used the opportunity to punch the idea home with APD leadership that officers cannot be seizing identification documents and destroying them or taking them away. They can't be maliciously seizing people's property. These are things that have been reported to our office since I became executive director in 2000, and we still have not seen them resolved. I'm hoping that what we have told APD will start to sink in.
Now, we're going to wrap up our show, and we're going to take one more call, but I do want to mention just these headlines I saw on our call system here. Someone saying, is there counseling for officers on edge in this agreement? And then another caller, Christina, saying this reform needs to go through Albuquerque and then be spread out through all of New Mexico. So I just want to mention, since we're not going to get to those callers, but we are going to get to Max briefly. Max, you have a point you'd like to make briefly, please, for us.
Yes, very much so. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a 77-year-old veteran, been in this town 9 years now. I've been living here, and I've been following what's been going on with the police department. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to take any of these so-called reforms seriously until and unless the police officers who shot that woman attorney a couple of years ago and killed her, and the cops who covered it up, until they give themselves up or somebody gives them up and they're held accountable for what happened, for what they did. Otherwise, it's just more whitewash.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Max. And so we do still have distrust on the part of the public. Max is referring to the Mary Hahn situation. Peter, briefly, you want to wrap up here?
I just have to say that, we as the community can't sit idly back and watch this reform process go on and hope it results in a reformed police department. We as the community have an obligation, have a responsibility to voice our opinions to the mayor's office about the way the reform process is going on over the next couple of years, because without community involvement, without the community's constant scrutiny on this, no, the reform process will not be successful. We as a community have a responsibility here.
All right. Thanks to our guests, Attorney Shannon Kennedy, the ACLU's Peter Simonson, and Rodley Balco, police militarization expert and author, who will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the South Broadway Cultural Center here in Albuquerque. We do hope you will join us next Thursday morning as we have the second part of this conversation. We will welcome Mayor Richard Berry, APD Chief Gordon Eden, and APD Academy Director Joe Wolf to the show. Part two of our conversation regarding the settlement agreement reached between the City of Albuquerque and the Department of Justice. This morning, we want to thank our engineer, Jefferson White, our assistant producer, Kaveh Movahed. Michael Hess has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on 89.9 KUNM and KUNM.org, a public service of the University of New Mexico.